A midweek Wednesday edition, September 2nd of Connecticut Today, right here on WICC. Republican State Rep. Vin Candelora checked in from North Brantford to talk about some controversy regarding whether or not the emergency powers of Governor Ned Lamont should be extended during the current coronavirus outbreak. And one of our regular guys checked in, 5 o'clock hour, Manchester J.I. editorialist Chris Powell, on a court ruling that could affect zoning regulations in many exclusive towns in Connecticut, some of those in Fairfield County. North Brantford State Rep. Assistant Minority Leader Vin Candelora is joining us. Vin, Paul, how are you, sir? Everything good?
Good, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Well, Vin, let's get into the weeds a little bit on this. For people that may not know, Vin, about the original declaration that the governor had, and now he wants an extension of this. I think he said the other day till something along the lines of February 5th or February 9th. But this is outside the purview, at least some Democrats think, of the General Assembly. Break down this whole situation for us.
So basically, in March, when we had this emergency come upon us, there are two provisions in statute which allow the governor to declare a public health emergency and or a civil preparedness emergency, which he did both. And there's a committee of 10 that met and approved that declaration, which essentially gives him very broad power to suspend, modify any state law or regulation. So essentially, he acts as the legislature, and he could change any law that he wants. And we've seen over time how he's issued very broad executive orders that have affected everything from business to landlord-tenant to public health. And those are all done through this extraordinary power that he's exercised for the last 6 months. Under the statute, he can make a declaration to extend those powers, which is what he did, through February. And the committee can come back within 72 hours of that declaration and say, no, we're not going to let you do that. We're going to limit that power. The clock is ticking. Friday is when the 72 hours runs out. And the Democrats are showing no indication that they want to go in to debate whether the power should be extended. And what Republicans are saying is we need to have this conversation because we aren't in the same position we were in March. The pandemic, you know, the governor's done a good job with this pandemic, but continuing to give this broad authority to allow him to affect areas that might not be public health related, I think we should be looking at limiting this power and bringing our voices back as a legislature.
So Vin, the original law here, or as you say, that's embedded in the state constitution, the state statutes, allows essentially, from what I'm hearing from you, it pretty much grants the governor executive fiat here to largely do whatever he wants untouched, at least at the outset here.
That's right. So, you know, it's a very extraordinary power. It's really a seizure of complete control, you know, over our laws. And while it can be exercised, you know, judiciously and tempered, you know, we don't have the ability to come in and stop it once these 72 hours expire. And so I think it merits the committee to get together and have a conversation about this and don't just allow it to happen and rubber stamp it without debate, because there's significant ramifications to this.
All right, Vin, hang on. I want to get into some of that, some of these ramifications when we come back. Republican State Rep. Vin Candelora, North Brantford, is with us on the phones for a few more minutes. Vin, hang on. Traffic and weather together on the sixes here at 3:36. It's a midweek Wednesday on WICC. All right, 3:38, almost 3:39:21 before 4 right here at WICC. Republican State Rep. Vin Candelora joining us to talk about the current controversy as to whether or not there's going to be any sort of a vote or substantive discussion as to the governor continuing his executive powers. Now, Vin, before we took the break, you said there's a lot to be looked into this, a lot of ramifications. In fact, Vin, we had a caller who just called in, wanted me to ask you, the powers that the governor does have here, and maybe this is what you were going to get to, you know, you said that they're total and absolute, and the caller wants to know, are they constitutional, both under the state constitution and the federal constitution? And you were saying that, that they pretty much are, correct?
Well, I think the powers that he exercises would need to fit within the framework of the Constitution. So the governor's authority doesn't allow him to modify the Constitution, I don't believe. He, however, could modify statutes. So, for instance, he couldn't change a constitutional provision, for instance, like the right to bear arms, but he could modify statutes that might deal with firearms. So it's a little distinction, but I think he would have to honor the words in the constitutional document.
And plus, he was also, in that court case that came down a couple of months ago, he was smacked down by a federal court when, as you recall, and we went into this here on the show, fingerprinting was put on hold for a lot of things. And I wondered aloud, and some of the members in the General Assembly obviously thought better. And, you know, the courts came down and said, no, you just can't stop fingerprinting for gun permits.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And that's, you know, I think, unfortunately, we're going to continue to see these executive orders challenged in court. I still wait to see how long, for instance, churches are going to hold out and continue to, limit their capacity to 100, even when they could physically distance inside the building and have more people there. We're allowing more people into Walmart than we are into our churches and synagogues. And, those are the issues that will continue now because of these executive orders. And I think those are the issues that we really need to have conversation on. You know, some of these measures, I think, are important public health measures. But then there's others that we need to have a conversation about, certainly if they're not science-based, but based on preferences by the administration.
So once this 72-hour holding period runs out, you said, Vin, in a couple of days, essentially then, are you telling me and telling the listeners here that the governor, again, will have this, unless he renounces it and says, okay, we're all better now, he'll have this executive fiat extra legislatively until early February?
Yeah, that's right. And what I find upsetting about this is that the order extends into the next legislative session. So the governor is, and the actions of this committee are binding a future legislature, which we've, really never have done that before. I think it's unconstitutional to bind a future legislature. So people that aren't even elected will get elected and sworn in January and are subject to these same restrictions. And I think if anything, these powers shouldn't be extending that long. I think the new leadership that takes over should have that ability to decide whether or not to extend these powers.
And Vin, here's one other thing that bothers me. And I started the show off today telling folks you'd be on and we get into this. Vin, whether it's this or a budget issue that you've been through many rounds in Hartford or police powers, anything that happens in this state, at least over the past few years, anyone, Vin, who doesn't seem to have a D next to their name, or any voter who doesn't vote Democrat or maybe a centrist or EGAD, a Republican in this state, it's sad because their input, at least externally, if you look at it from afar, Vin, their input, it seems not to matter.
No, I mean, we're starting to see the process take on sort of a bullying form that, as much as some of these progressives have denounced Trump for, they exhibit that same behavior. So, we saw it with the police accountability bill. If you had a different opinion, you're just called racist. And there's not that sort of open dialogue that I think we need to bring back to the process. And in this situation, it's disturbing that, granted, we are in the minority. In the end of the day, we might not win the vote, but we should at least have the conversation. And the fact that Democrats are not even willing to convene this committee meeting to have the conversation should frighten everybody. And we're seeing one power rule at its worst, and the people of Connecticut are not better off for that.
Now, Vin, technically on this committee, if the committee was convened, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this 10-member committee, would there have to be a vote Is there a prescribed vote that must take place or not?
No, I don't think they're required to vote. But I think, again, they would have a conversation. It would be open to the public. People would be held accountable. And so by not having a meeting at all, we don't have a conversation. And, you know, so today we felt it was important at least to have this press conference because it now is going to force that conversation in the public so we can see how the Democrats feel about this and how the governor feels about it. But and I think it's important to be on record because, you know, 5 months from now, we are only beginning to see the economic impacts of some of these decisions and some of the ancillary public health impacts, like the rise in domestic violence and the rise in suicide, the rise in drug addiction. There's other pieces to this pandemic that we should be having a conversation about and trying to address, and we don't have that ability because the governor has usurped all of that power.
So the bottom line is, I'm taking away from this, Vin, that if this meeting were held, then the public, by state statute and state fiat, they would get to see and hear about the, at least the discussions and the debate that these 10 members were having. And because that's not going to happen, again, the people, you're telling me, are pretty much shut out of the process.
Yeah, that's right.
Vin, I thank you as always for the time. Republican State Rep Vin Candelora, North Brantford, Assistant Minority Leader. Vin, thank you. Have a good weekend. We'll talk down the line. Thanks, Vin.
Yep.
All right, bye-bye. Al, our buddy from the Manchester Journal-Inquirer. One of your many columns, you wrote one a couple of days ago that has to do with zoning and something that's been bubbling up. I know there are certain forces now that say that, you know, the state's zoning regulations are under a microscope. They should be rehashed. There are other cozy little towns in the state saying, no, don't do that. Talk a little about what you wrote about here and about a court decision that came out regarding this.
Yeah, I was prompted to write because I stumbled across a couple of zoning stories, one from Westport, one from Vernon, where the neighbors of development proposals for apartment complexes were complaining that projects should not be allowed because they were going to increase traffic and cause safety problems. I mean, this has been the case with, zoning in Connecticut almost back to colonial times. It's coming under more scrutiny now because the zoning is being used, or it has the effect of increasing racial segregation in the state. Most of the state's minority population lives in only something like 20 of the state's 169 towns, and certainly suburbs have been using zoning to really control their demographics. And if you have one acre minimum lot size requirements, and you don't allow condos or apartments, you're pretty much saying, you know, only the wealthy are going to be allowed to live here. I mean, it's an old story. It's being more criticized now because of concerns about racial issues. I just picked up on it in the column because the objections, the typical objections to multifamily housing, that you know, it's going to increase traffic and cause safety problems. They're kind of hypocritical because, you know, nobody complains that he's going to cause, you know, traffic when he moves into a neighborhood. It's only after he's got his apartment or condo or house that, you know, anybody else becomes traffic. I mean, he's not traffic. It's the people who follow you into the neighborhood who become traffic. I mean, it's impossible for us to have any kind of economic growth or racial or socioeconomic integration in Connecticut unless we have more housing development. And, we're never going to have any housing development as long as we let people block housing development with the claim that, oh, it's going to be, you know, too much traffic or too much safety problems. Well, you know, any growth brings traffic. Any growth brings safety problems.
Yeah, Chris, I've always been a little what would the word be? A little leery of the word traffic, or traffic studies need to be done, or we need to evaluate the flow of traffic. I mean, to me, as you say, it's kind of become this lazy kind of kill all phrase. Let's just say there's a traffic problem and we can, in a sense, go into kind of a four corner stall on this, right?
Yeah, well, we all want to live in what the real estate ads call a park-like setting. You know, we want to be the only person for, you know, a few hundred yards around. And then, you know, right beyond the buffer, we've got the supermarket and we've got the doctor's office and the hospital and the school. But, you know, we want to live in the park-like setting. And not only that, we want the rest of society to pay for that buffer. We don't want to have to pay for it ourselves unless we're billionaires and we can buy the park around our house. And, you know, this has consequences. It has consequences for racial segregation. It has consequences for really economic progress for young people. They can't find housing. They can't live near their jobs. You know, these zoning objections, I think, are very fairly challenged. In the Westport case, a judge, Andrew Rohrbach, overturned the Planning and Zoning Commission's rejection of the apartment proposal, and the judge said the apartment proposal can go ahead. The town wants to appeal. I don't know how that will end up, but the suburbs in Connecticut tend to be more exclusive than they should be, and this problem probably can't be addressed without restricting the use of zoning for exclusive purposes.
And there's also, Chris Powell, there's also, I believe, an organization who is very active, and I believe the wife of Hartford's mayor, Luke Bronin, is involved in this organization called Desegregate Connecticut. There have also been members of the General Assembly, I believe Saud Anwar is one, the state Senate Democrat, saying that this is kind of going to be a key issue now by majority Democrats, or taken up by majority Democrats in the General Assembly come the turn of the year, that they are, you know, contemplating things like, you know, holding back per se on state funding for some of these towns as kind of a roundabout way to take control of their zoning regulations.
Yeah, that's, you know, one way to encourage you know, more liberal housing in the suburbs. I'm glad Senator Anwar has come around on this issue. Not long ago, he was mayor of South Windsor, which was and still is a very exclusive town. And when he was mayor, he certainly wasn't pushing for more affordable housing in town.
Chris, hang on. We'll be back with you with more. Chris Powell is the guest, the former managing editor of the Manchester Journal Inquirer, currently now one of the editorial writers, one of the best in the state, if not, in my humble opinion, the best in the state. And we'll have more with Chris Powell. First, traffic and weather together on WICC. Back here on WICC, a few more minutes with one of our go-to guests, Chris Powell, managing editor, former managing editor of the Manchester JI, now chief editorial writer, one of the editorial writers there. Chris, I wanted to touch on one other thing, or at least one other thing that I found interesting, this ongoing cha-cha that we have now between, involving, I should say, the Secretary of the State's office, and all of a sudden this somewhat of an about-face or an oh-by-the-way regarding the handling of ballots for the upcoming election in November with the mail-in ballots and everything, and there always seems to be something interesting that comes out of Denise Merrill's office. It never fails to impress.
Well, I guess she's really turning the matter over to the local officials to handle. You know, we're not used to doing so much balloting by mail, and you know, I can't say that it's necessarily going to fail or necessarily going to be corrupt. But I think there was a reason why we've been voting in person all these years, and I think it had something to do with security. You know, when you get something in the mail, you really can't be sure where it came from. You can't be sure of the circumstances under which the ballot was filled out. Now, that doesn't mean they're necessarily corrupt, but it's certainly, to me anyway, it's not as secure as in person voting. There's a tactic called ballot harvesting now, where people are allowed to collect a bunch of ballots, absentee ballots from, you know, housing complexes and things like that, and that increases the insecurity of the system. Now, I think the local registrars are probably a lot more competent at this than the Secretary of the State's office. I have not been impressed by Secretary Merrill's indifference to issues of ballot security and election integrity. But I'm not sure this is a good way to do it, and I think the Democrats are ginning up, you know, concern about, you know, catching the virus at polling places that is really exaggerated. I don't think the science supports those fears as much as the Democrats would like them to, and I think the Democrats would very much like to have more balloting by mail because they think it's going to help them.
And if this builds, Chris, this builds into the cynicism that you and I read and hear from people every day. And, you know, I take calls on this show. People say, well, you know, the other states, they vote by mail. But, yeah, but they didn't try to put the thing together, you know, haphazardly in a month or two. I mean, as you know, Chris, some of those northwestern states did 3 or 4 or 5 years of study. They have separate bodies that watch all these things. So it really is, although the theory is the same, it's been executed in that part of the country with a much more careful prospect.
Yeah, and there's another concern here, too, is I don't know that this is exactly the way the Democrats feel about it, but some Republicans are saying with some plausibility, I think, that Democrats want people to vote by mail now before they see Joe Biden performing in a debate. You know, that's a problem with mail-in voting in advance. You don't get to see the whole campaign before you vote. And I can see, given their candidate, the Democrats might not want people to see too much of Biden before voting for him. I mean, he might be very popular now as the anti-Trump, mm-hmm. but if we, you know, see more of his mini strokes in his interviews and in his debates where he just seems lost in his train of thought, you know, people might change their minds, whereas I think everybody's already made up his mind about Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, and on that note, let me ask you, I don't know how much you've been eyeballing of either convention over the past couple of weeks or what your thoughts are. What do you think of this whole campaign? I mean, everybody has Trump, at least at this point, you know, down and dead. But, you know, as you say, Mr. Biden still, as a working member of the media, kind of disappoints me for having not really had any real, what we call in the business, Chris, open pressers, you know, not these softball video hookups with, you know, a very nice morning show somewhere. Can he take this all the way to November, or is he going to have to show that he's got a little more on his fastball here?
I think either of these candidates could surprise us. I mean, if Trump could just calm down and behave like a normal human being, he'd probably shock half the country. And if Biden could ever stop stumbling and saying silly things, you know, maybe he'd shock the country too. But I have to admit, Paul, I am so disgusted with these guys and really the whole national scene.
How did we get here? How did we end up with these two guys? I have relatives who know I follow this stuff all the time and say, explain this to me, Paul. And I say, well, I can't.
Well, H.L. Mencken, the great newspaper columnist and satirist, 100 years ago wrote the following paragraph, which is, I think, pretty much applicable today. He says, democracy is that system of government under which the people, having 35,717,342 native-born adult white men to choose from, including many who are handsome and thousands who are wise, pick out a Coolidge to be the head of the state. It is as if a hungry man set before a banquet prepared by master cooks and covering a table an acre in area should turn his back upon the feast and stay his stomach by catching and eating flies.
Well,
and Mencken wrote that 100 years ago, and I think Coolidge turned out to be a fairly good president.
Yeah, but, and I got to tell you, I was pretty impressed by the way you could just rattle that off. I like that.
Well, no, actually, while we were talking, I looked it up. I have it on my computer here because I have to refer to it so often. But yeah, how did we come to this point?
It's
where
amazing.
These are the two best guys we've got in the country. It's like, they're the two worst guys we've got in the country.
It's amazing. Chris Powell, Manchester J.I., editorialist, columnist. Chris, thank you as always. Great to talk to you, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Paul.